Welcome to the Driving Change Podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network, where we live at the intersection of neuroscience and storytelling. If you love great stories and you love understanding the mindset it takes to be a world-class change agent, then join us as our fascinating guests from all walks of life unpack their unique journeys of perseverance and passion, of expertise and experience, and be inspired to use your own story to drive change. Well, welcome back to the Driving Change Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Bloomfield. Today's guest, I'm excited about for a lot of different reasons. One, I met Hillary Phelps. I don't know, it's been a year or two ago when I met you at an event that we both were speaking at, and I heard your story for the first time. And I knew, obviously, of you and your family, and she's the older sister to Michael Phelps, taught him everything he needed to know to become a gold medalist swimmer. Herself was, we'll get into this in a minute, a world-class swimmer herself. When I heard her story, I thought, boy, this is going to be a great story for our show as well. And the amount of just life lessons that your journey has taught you that's going to teach a lot of our listeners today and hopefully inspire them in a little bit of a different way. I don't want to get too far into your credentials because I want to unpack your story and let the audience listen to this because I think you're going to be amazed at not only the journey, but I think many of you are going to connect with some of the trials and tribulations of Hillary's life and the things that she's discovered along the way in her pursuit of overcoming some of these things, and then now what she's doing to help others do the same. So if that's not a big enough teaser for you to listen to this episode, I don't know what is. So Hillary, welcome to the Driving Change Podcast. It's an honor to have you on.
Oh, thank you. It's such an honor to be here. I'm grateful for this conversation.
So I started to tease the audience a little bit. And you know, most people, obviously, many of us watched your brother win gold medals in the Olympics, and we knew the Phelps family, and we followed a little bit of that history over the years. But what we don't know is his older sister Hillary was a world class swimmer in her own right. And I want you to share some of that a little bit as you tell us your story. But let's go back a little even further. Tell us a little bit about your origin story. Where are you from? What were some of your earlier influences? What was it like growing up Phelps? And then maybe jump into your journey from there.
So I'm the oldest of three. It's myself, and then we have a sister, Whitney, and then Michael's the youngest. And, you know, we grew up in the woods, which sounds very funny. My parents bought a big plot of land, and they built their dream home. So my sister and I, in their early years, spent a lot of time in nature. We spent a lot of time riding bikes and exploring and had a really wonderful childhood. I started swimming when I was seven. So it was the year that Michael was born. My parents put us into, you know, the local swimming club just to get some energy out. And I loved it. I loved it. And I had a little bit of a natural ability early on. And I got this third place trophy. And I said to my mom, you know what? That third place isn't good enough. I want the big one. I want the big trophy, the big first place trophy. And she said, well, you know, the kids that get those trophies are year-round swimmers. I'm like, great, tie me up. Like, just do it. And so that's what we did. And I started swimming year-round from there. My parents, you know, we were around the pool from a really early age when I was 6 months, going back a little bit. They kind of did this. They dropped me in the pool. My dad was in there waiting for me. My mom dropped me in and I just kind of floated to the surface. And I've always been, my whole family has just been this, had this love of water. And I was really good, really quick, started getting first place trophies. I was also a straight A student. So I loved to read. I was really curious. I loved knowledge. And then in sixth grade, there came a moment, and I shared this when we met, of these girls. And I just changed schools. I'd gone from, you know, all the friends that I grew up with. My parents got me a boundary exception because I was the fastest swimmer in the country at age 11. In my event, I was a distance swimmer, so I swam the mile. And so we went to a different club. And so my parents did everything in their power to give us access to the best so we could do our best. And so different school, different practice schedules. And these girls said, oh, you have nice shoes, which sounds like such an innocuous comment, you know, just kind of teenage girl stuff. But something in that moment clicked in my mind, and their voices, somebody else's voices, became louder than mine. And I had this overwhelming feeling of, well, I'm not good enough. even though I had these straight A's and I was the fastest swimmer in the country, you know, and someone said, well, if you train harder and studied, if you studied harder and trained faster, then you'd be better. And I'm like, oh, I'm already really good. I don't, you know, how can I get better? And so there was something inside that said, I'm not pretty enough, smart enough, funny enough, good enough at whatever I was doing. And that's when I started drinking and exploring with drugs.
Wow. So I think so many people can relate to that. I mean, obviously you had this performance gene in you, like you had this competition gene. I bet you probably still have, if we took you to the Strength Finders, you know, I'm top five, you know, competition is one of my top five strengths. It's probably still one of your top five strengths as well. That was somehow just genetically part of who you were, right? You wanted to win. You wanted to get good grades. You wanted to be the best swimmer. And so there's something in you that was driven to win, to be successful. And I think for a lot of us that have that, wherever it comes from, whether it's environmental or genetic or whatever, when you hit that moment in life, when I love what you just said, when other people's voices start to become louder than your own, and you start to believe things because other people generally do that, especially in our teen years, because they're jealous of someone who's winning and successful and they're trying to lift themselves up. What was it within you? So you, I think you're what, 14, 15? Was that when the drinking started for you?
It's 14. Mm-hmm.
When you think about your environment that you were around then, were you isolated from, you didn't have those core friends that were kind of living a life that was like, hey, they weren't going to stop you from doing that, or they were participating in it? Or what was the environment like that kind of started to fuel that allowed it to keep persisting?
Sure. And I also think the competitiveness came from within. You know, it wasn't anybody else said. It was like definitely like an innate trait. And it was to be my best. It was never to beat anybody else. Like I just wanted to be the best. And so when I moved, it was when we moved schools to be closer to the pool. So my parents sold their dream home and we moved to Baltimore and to be closer to the pool, because my dad was driving me from 3:45 every morning. We'd leave the house at 4. I'd swim from 5 to 7, go to a different school where my mom was teaching. You know, so my parents really accommodated this drive to be successful. And when I went to a new school, I didn't fit in. I was always, and I still am, I call myself, you know, like I'm a little nerdy. I love knowledge. I love information. I love really deep conversations. I'm not great at surface level things. And I felt like an outcast. I felt different. I sat by myself at lunch. I used to have really curly hair and these big red glasses. And I was really unique in that I just kind of marched to my own drum. And when I changed schools in 7th grade, I realized I just don't really fit in. All the other girls were, we lived in Baltimore, and all the other girls were playing lacrosse and soccer. And I was swimming, and it's a really niche sport. And I really wanted to fit in. And so kind of hanging around, you know, different people allowed that opportunity to explore the drinking. And you know, at the same time, and I never, this isn't a blame, you know, my parents went through a divorce when I was 15. And so kind of all of this, and what all that did was allow me to explore my drinking a little bit more, because there was, you know, my mom was working, my dad was working, we lived, you know, my dad had moved out, and my mom had 3 kids. My sister was really good. My sister started coming up. My sister was third in the world at 14. My brother, so we had different practice schedules, and my mom's a teacher, and my dad's a police officer, and we work another job so we could have, you know, pay the swimming fees. And so there was just a lot of space to explore that. And I did.
Wow. So you being the oldest, I mean, that was part of it too. I mean, there was also this whole, I'm sure this pressure of the oldest, your parents are going through a divorce now, you have the younger siblings who are coming up and their schedules are crazy, and you feel like you're a little bit different already. I think this speaks to so many people, and I hope we have teens that are listening to this. And I know that you know, when this is launched, I'm going to send this out to a lot of my kids and their friends as well, because I think there's people that do a lot of things and they hide in the dark, if you will, with something like this. In today's world with social media, that's the addiction for half the kids. And the other kids, it could be drugs, it could be alcohol, it could be something. And they're hiding it in the dark because they're just trying to find a way that they feel some sense of control over something. Is that how you felt maybe then?
I did. And the best way I think of the easiest way I can describe that is that you're trying to find an external for something external to quiet an internal chaos, right? So that's drinking, shopping, drugs, sex, food, whatever that is. And so social media to try to quiet that calm, you know, to try to calm the chaos inside. And something someone said to me was so powerful the other day. She's a 14-year-old daughter. And she said, I told my daughter not to put on a mask, always be you, because like me, it could take you 20 years to remove that mask and actually show your authentic self. And I was blown away by that. But I think to your point, it's really hard with social media to say, because looking back, I can say like, oh, it really didn't matter if I was a cool kid or if I was like them, you know, now at 46, I have a little bit of perspective. But then it was, that's all that mattered was being accepted, you know, being a part of, wanting to feel special and cool. I think kids today have it a lot harder than I did, than we did.
Yeah. There's so much more external pressure, it feels like, because they have so many more voices. We talked about the voice external being louder than the voice internal.
That's right.
But when we were growing up, the voice external was just a small circle of people for the most part that we were around all the time. Now that voice external is, could be thousands of people.
That's right.
Because these kids are hearing it from everywhere. And I don't know if you know this or not, if you're listening, but the social media, the people on social media aren't always the kindest at giving you the best voices you need to hear. So what happens then? So 14, 15, you start in on the drinking, and probably at the time it was easy to justify. You're just, you know, just a kid blowing off steam, kind of, this is how you're coping with things. It's normal. Kids do things like this. And as you went through high school, I think you went on to college and swam as well. Does this continue to follow you, this pattern?
It did. You know, and I think looking back, what I realized not too long ago was that I think I just had a little bit of depression. I think I was struggling. My sister started to become faster than me. My brother was really excelling. And I couldn't find my place. I didn't know who I was. I lost my voice. I lost confidence. And so for me, drinking was a way to self-medicate. Mm. And because, you know, back then, it also... you know, mental health wasn't really a thing. I mean, it's only in the past couple of years that it's become acceptable that kids are going to therapy, that it's more talked about. And so I'm hoping that will really help a lot of kids see that they are good enough and our authentic voice is the most powerful. But I did. I swam through college. I got a full scholarship to the University of Richmond. I swam for 4 years and I have no idea. How I'd go to practice in the morning. I was, like I said, I was a distance swimmer. So I had two practices and I graduated. My grades weren't great. But I did it in 4 years. And I thought that college was a big excuse to party. I thought it was just a really expensive, you know, cover charge for having fun. And that's, and I, to my, you know, fullest ability did just that. I was a blackout drinker, which, meant that every time I drank alcohol, I would forget what happened. I would black out. And I thought, because we weren't really talking about it in college, that that's how everybody else drank too. You know, I thought that when people woke up with a hangover, then their hangovers were just like mine. But what mine were, it's like walking pneumonia. You know, my body hurt, my brain hurt. Where other people maybe just didn't get a good night's sleep. It was really different. And I think that's a really powerful change that can happen at the collegiate level too, is having these conversations, because it's easy to hide. It's easy, really easy to hide your addiction or to foster it or grow it in college, because there's always somebody that's willing to drink or do drugs or have fun. And it was a really easy way to grow my addiction quickly.
Yeah, this is so good. My oldest daughter is leading a group called Young Life at Ohio State. So she's passionate about helping mentor young women going through college right now. And we talk a lot about this concept and how it really comes down to identity. And you know, what if you don't believe and know with confidence who you are, then you're going to look for that identity in all these other places. And for you, that was alcohol, right? Alcohol gave you an identity, or at least helped you numb the identity you didn't want to have that you thought you were, but you really weren't.
That's right. I wanted to be the fun girl. And like I said earlier, that's just, I'm not the boisterous. I'm not funny. I mean, you know, I'm more serious and I love to learn and I love deep conversations. And I always wanted to be the opposite of that. And so alcohol gave me that permission slip to be that person or try to be that person. But the challenging thing was with alcohol, you never knew who you were going to get. When I started putting alcohol in my body, sometimes it was that really fun party girl. Sometimes it was super sappy and sad and like, oh, I love you. This is the best. My, you know, sometimes it was that girl just looked at me funny and I want to fight, which is hard to say because it's not who I am. But it's the thing when I started pouring it in my body, you just never knew which version of Hillary was going to come out. And that got kind of scary when you add in the blackouts.
Wow. And I think that this is, I love that you're sharing this story now, and I want to hear more about when you had that realization in a second. But this journey from 14 to, let's just put you in your early 20s, I mean, you'd become a professional drinker at that point, right? I mean, you became so good at it that you learned how to use that. And maybe you were lying to yourself. Maybe others saw it and they didn't, you know, it was because of the environment that no one said anything because everybody was participating. But you became pretty good, I'm guessing, at almost being able to stay in this space as an addicted person without others really realizing that you had this issue. Is that fair or no? You think people actually knew it, but no one really wanted to say anything to you about it.
Well, people knew and they said things. You know, my college roommates in my senior year said something to me like, we're really concerned. And this is the easiest way to, I've just tried to describe addiction to someone's like, we don't get it. And I was like, it's like having a best friend who's trying to kill you, right? Because it's causing all this chaos in your life, but you can't let it go. And so that was the way my life looked. And they said something, but I would also find relationships. You know, I would date men who were the same, right? Nobody ever really held me accountable because they had their own struggles with addiction, or they had a family member that was an alcoholic. There's some codependence there. I mean, so I always found those relationships, and then I would surround myself with people that drank like me. But you're right, I became this professional drinker of, I'd wake up in the morning in pain and hungover and but looking forward to when I could drink again. And I spent the day consumed by the hangover. And then by the time the evening came, I'm like, oh, I feel great. I can start drinking again. So I was either recovering from drinking, actively drinking, or thinking about the next time I was going to drink. And that took up so much headspace and took such a toll on my physical body that I love that term. Yeah, I was a professional drinker. And I learned to hide it or try to hide it. You know, like I did this thing where I'd buy wine. I'd buy a case of wine for Christmas presents. And I would tell the liquor store, I'm buying this case of wine for people. I'm going to give them away for Christmas. And then I would go home and drink them. So I wouldn't have to go back to the liquor store for a while. You know, and you hear these things, I'd go to this liquor store on Monday and this liquor store on Wednesday. And I would try to change them. So you start to create kind of little tricks or different ways to protect your drinking. Right. You know, I started setting these parameters. I'm only going to drink on the week. This was after college. I'm only going to drink on the weekend. And then the weekend would look like a Thursday. And then, well, I mean, I'm 23 and having a glass of wine with dinner is what adults do. So I'm going to have one. But with addiction, with me, I can't have one glass. I can't have two glasses. I will drink everything in front of me until I black out. And that's how I drank. And so I became skilled at trying to hide it or do it in secret or try to create safety around it by creating external guidelines to what my drinking would look like. But I would always push the boundary of them and, you know, change them the next day.
Well, I mean, think about it. Your personality from the time you were a kid was you wanted to be the best. And to be the best, right. Get the best grades, be the best swimmer. Well, dang it, you're going to be the best drinker, right?
That's right. Yeah. And that's 100% right. If anything I'm going to do, I'm going to go down a blaze of glory. And it was, yes, that's accurate.
Now, what do you think at that point in your life? So what I love to do, what we love to do at Brain Trust is explore a lot of like the behavioral aspects of how people... Habits are really big to us, and we look at them in the business world through what are your communication habits and what are your work habits and things like that, and how do you rewire new habits in the brain. With addiction, it's a little different because it's habitual, and there's a behavioral component to it, but it's also there's a biological component to it, because addiction, it literally can rewire your brain in a way that changes the brain chemistry and can change some of the neuronal structures of the brain itself. Have you looked into that at all through any of your behavioral side of like, what was, because I don't have experience in addiction recovery personally, But I know there's a behavioral component, but then there's also a biological component. And how do you rewire, start to rewire things over top of those to get you to a new step? And that, so when you're in college, I'm sure it wasn't even crossing your mind. We can get into when you actually had the awareness in a second, but I'm just curious in your own opinion, how you've worked through that idea of changing behavior versus, man, I had to kind of learn how to rewire my brain in a lot of ways.
So the scary thing was when the things we just talked about, kind of the coping mechanisms that I would use when I was really drunk, I would ride the metro and I would take a magazine and I'd pretend to read it because I didn't want to talk to anybody because I was so out of it. When I got sober, this is the girl, going back to the girl that got straight A's, loved to read and loved knowledge. Jeff, my reading comprehension was gone. I couldn't understand. I tried to read and I was like, I don't know what's going on. And that was really scary. And that felt demoralizing because that's who I was. I loved to read. I would read books multiple every single day when I was little. And so to your point, there are biological changes that happen. And when I came in, I had to learn, but it was, what did I want? Did I want to continue drinking and keep going down that path of just pain and suffering? Or was I willing to look at my behaviors and the things that, you know, that I was doing on a daily, my rituals, and change them? And so for me, it really came down to community, like surrounding, we talked about this a little bit in the beginning, surrounding myself with people that were doing the same thing, that were trying not to drink one day at a time. And it also looked like changing those rituals of every single day. You know, at the end of the day, I would come home and I would drink a lot, you know, I would drink wine, or so now I drink, and it's not this trivial or simple, but this is the high level, you know, I would drink tea instead. When I talked about this the other day, I had to look at if I was hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, that HALT acronym, because a lot of the times I was hungry and I just needed some food, or I was really angry and I needed to connect with somebody. But a lot of times I would spend the nights. So when I got sober, I lived in Washington, D.C., and we can talk about that. You said kind of the change, yep, the impetus for change, but my life had gotten to a point where I was lost and just scared of everything and felt lonely and broken. My friends were all married and having kids, and I was still existing in this life of just letting the time pass me by. And I didn't want that anymore, but that had to come from really deep inside, right? That want to change, like, you know, the driving change, like that want to change had to come from inside me. A lot of people had said things about my drinking, and I was more willing to cut them out of my life at the time than I was to actually look at my behavior. I just wasn't ready. And once I was ready, I asked for help. I continuously surrounded myself with people that weren't drinking. And if I didn't know what to do, there were times when I would drive to Target. There's a Target's open 12 or still midnight, sorry, in Alexandria. I live just outside of DC. And I would drive there on a Friday night. I would go to, so 12 steps were a huge part of my recovery. I would go to a 12 step meeting. I would get in the car. I would drive to Target and I would walk up and down the aisles for hours by myself. It was before they sold wine there. Because I just didn't want the temptation. You know, I didn't keep alcohol in my home. I got rid of Listerine because I heard of people that in a, you know, pinch drank that, NyQuil, vanilla with alcohol in it. Because you hear these stories and I didn't want to be that person. But for me, we called it feelings management in recovery and in the treatment center. I didn't know how to manage my feelings. And oftentimes emotions are the triggers that take us back out. Because I didn't know, I was still that 14-year-old little girl. So I was stunted emotionally right from the time I started drinking heavily. And I had to go back and work with that inner child that felt abandoned and scared and lonely. And so my emotions were all over the place. I was angry one day and happy the next. And I use this idea of like a pendulum swing of going from really happy and this is the greatest life ever to going angry and I don't want to talk to anybody and I want to be by myself and, you know, just isolate for a while. But the idea was to have that emotional regulation to kind of get in the middle. And that looks like things like owning my responsibilities, saying I'm sorry to people that I hurt when I was active in addiction, surrounding myself with other people who think like me, act like me, and want to not drink one day at a time. moving my body every single day. Meditation and prayer became really huge. Being mindful of what I was putting into my brain. What am I watching on TV? What am I reading? You know, there are some days when the news is just overwhelming. I mean, there's a lot and it's chaotic. And if I allow that external chaos to infiltrate my internal world, I can start getting really wound up. And for me, not today, but, you know, early in recovery, that being really wound up could lead back to using a drink or a drug. So I'm really mindful of all of those holistic ways that contribute to my emotional well-being, physical, spiritual.
So how old were you then? Because I think a lot of times the misnomer is that, oh yeah, one day I just woke up. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to fix this. I'm not going to do this anymore. And I don't think it's usually that way. Usually it's a process. Like, at what point did you have the first initial recognition that this isn't working for me? I need to start doing something. And then what did that process look like for you? Meaning, like, did it take an extra, before you really started to get into a groove and you realized, okay, I'm going to be sober. And now you started counting the days of sobriety. Like, what, how old were you when it started, the first initial inspiration to do something about it happened? And then how long did it take you? Because I think this is really important for people listening who might feel like they're hopeless. Like, I could start this and I want to do it, but then I'm just going to fall right back off the wagon tomorrow. And to know that there's a journey involved, you don't just flip the switch and you're done, you're sober.
That's right. I was probably 25 when I started exploring or started having the ideas that this might be too much. It stopped being cute, is what I say. I was still blacking out. I was still able to, I was still able to keep a job, but, the physical consequences of drinking increased. So what I mean by that is I would wake up in the morning, like literally physical pains in my kidneys, like I was being stabbed in them and it just hurt so much. And I'd lost relationships. You know, I was in a relationship and he's like, you know what, you need to monitor your drinking or I'm out. And I was like, okay, bye. And we'd been dating for like 2 years. I mean, so things like that when I was like, okay, but people had kept dropping that hint that, you know what, there could be something going on here. And then I was in a relationship and he had said, you know, if you don't get help, and I tried to go to 12 steps a couple of times, I just wasn't ready. I would go for 3 months, but I wasn't accountable. I wasn't doing the things I needed to do. I would just kind of go and assumed that everything would change. I thought that once I stopped drinking alcohol, my life would immediately get better and improve. But what I learned was that alcohol was just a symptom of the disease. Alcohol was what I used to try to fix something that was inside of me and it wasn't working. So when I stopped drinking alcohol, I felt physically better, but all of the things that I drank over, lack of self-esteem, no self-confidence, very little self-love, if any, all of those things started bubbling up. So while I was sleeping better, I was moving my body, I didn't have the inflammation from the sugar, all of those things, the emotional reasons why I drank were still there. And I had just...
And you lost your best friend. You let your best friend that would tell you, it's okay, I'm here for you.
And I lost my best friend. There's grief. That's right. It was grief. And people in recovery will tell you that because, you know, alcohol was the one thing I turned to in every situation. I was happy, I was sad, I was angry, I was depressed, I was lonely. I did laundry, I cleaned the house. It was always there for me until it wasn't. And there was a time when it just stopped working. And a lot of people that get sober will tell you it stopped working for them, meaning they couldn't reach that level of anesthetism or numbness that they desire, you know, that they desired, that had, it just stopped working. And it stopped working for me. I drank 2 bottles of wine and then I drank 6 glasses of wine at a hotel bar in 30 minutes. And I didn't get drunk. I just got really sick. And I was like, my best friend failed me. This is it. And so for me, the shame was what helped me to see that I wanted to get help. But when I went into treatment, I went to outpatient. I said, if this doesn't work, I'll go to inpatient. You know, I wasn't really sure. But one of the key things was accountability. They asked us every day. And, you know, being a coach, you know this, like the accountability is so important. And so for me, when I went in and they'd say, how many meetings did you get to this week? You know, what did you do? Who did you surround yourself with? And I needed that accountability and then that feelings management piece and the ability to finally start releasing some of the stuff, the shame I held inside. I was so embarrassed that I drank by myself, that I would drink in secret. And when I started talking openly, I was like, well, I used to sneak drinks. And people are like, me too, me too, me too, me too. And I was like, oh, I'm not so bad. Because the story time that I would tell myself is I'm the worst human on the planet. I can't believe I'm doing, you know, all of these things that we can perpetuate we can tell ourselves the story time, the negative things, or we can fill it with the more positive things. And my mind was always going to the negative of self-deprecation and loathing. And so getting into that treatment center and having other people that say, I see you, it's okay, you're right where you're supposed to be, was really helpful for me in my healing process.
What I love, this will bridge us into where I think your work has gone today, but I love what you said also about probably back before you were 25, you would surround yourself with people that as you learn more things about them, they would raise their hand and be me too, and you wouldn't feel alone, but they were in the same behavior you were in. So you were just finding people who were justifying the same bad behavior, and then that would become a community.
Yes.
To some degree. And so it wasn't until you realized that you needed to find yourself a community of people who were raising their hands saying, hey, me too, but not because I'm proud of it, but because I don't feel alone and I want to do something better and do something different. And so you started at 29, I think. That's when you, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't that when you finally...
That's right.
That was the line, right?
That was it. And it was the treatment. It was all of those things that helped me. And then I started to feel better, and it's the accountability. And I'll say it's not perfect. Like I thought I put down alcohol, it would be perfect. Or I have 5 years, then life is going to feel really good. Life still happens. There are still ups and downs. You know, I'd shared this. I lost my dad in 2022. And I had 15 years of sobriety. And it was really the first time when I was like, don't care. I'm doing it. I'm going out. And I didn't, because I had the time. I had the tools. I had the people, you know, I had all that, the work behind me. But it doesn't stop showing up. It's just, what am I doing today that's going to prevent me from going out and picking up a drink?
And I want to go back to, because this is where I think you're making such an impact now. And I didn't know that. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. I didn't know that. So that's something I learned today.
Halt.
And I'm wondering how many people are listening to that. If you're experiencing hunger or anger, or you're lonely or tired, it tends to trigger behaviors in your life that may not be healthy, whether it's drinking or whether it's in fill in the blank, right? Whatever your bad behaviors are that speak to your lack of identity.
Self-destructive.
Those are some of the triggers, right? Those triggers evoke an emotion. Those emotions generate a response, which creates a behavior, which turns into a habit. And you tend to find your path to do that over and over again in some form of addiction in your life. It could be social media. It could be sex. It could be drugs. It could be alcohol. It could be food. It could be unhealthy relationships. It's whenever you're experiencing many times those things, you will tend to gravitate toward that same habitual path to ease that feeling and that pain, to not feel that. And then it turns into the opposite of who you're trying to be. When you've solved that in your own life, yet you haven't solved it like, oh, I'm above it now. You clearly just said there's still moments when you get triggered and you really have to go deep into your toolbox to make sure that you don't slip back there. And now you're actually helping create toolboxes for other, particularly other women. And I love the concept of, you recognize you were in the wrong crowd with the wrong people, many times in the wrong room, and you decided to do something different and help others now with your purpose in life as you move forward with the rest of it. Tell us a little bit about what you've created and how that's making a difference for particularly women.
And so my purpose, I think, was really defined by, so I kept my recovery and my sobriety quiet for 15 years. There were people around me that did not know I was in recovery, or they just thought I didn't drink because I was healthy. You know, I'm certified or have studied mindfulness, meditation, yoga, Pilates, breath work, like fill in the blank, because I'm that knowledge seeker and because it's helped me. And so they just figured she doesn't drink because she's healthy, or, you know, right. And what it really was is that I still felt shame. And I had a moment, you know, after COVID, when the world shut down and people, I mean, that's numbers in drinking skyrocketed, right? And I had a moment when I'm like, you know what? I have 15 years. I'm probably safe to say that I will never have a drink again. While it's only one day at a time and I probably won't drink today, it's, my life today is so much better than it was then. So it's pretty safe to say that I won't. But what about that woman that has one day, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year? And if she feels shame and she feels alone and she feels isolated, then, well, I don't have the luxury to stay silent anymore. If that one woman could hear my story and feel less alone, whether that's on social media, whether it's through interview, or podcast, whatever that looks like. And through that pain of my recovery and my addiction, I found my purpose was to help other women. And what that means is I've used all of that knowledge. I'm also a holistic coach. I'm studying some somatic experience work. And what that means to me is that I get to use all of those tools to help other women feel less alone, whether they're going through, I say in transition. So addiction, divorce, changing jobs, the kids have left the home, whatever that looks like. Because as women, we continue to change and evolve and grow into different and better iterations of ourselves, our true self. But my experience is that sometimes, and this was my experience, we get boxed in, or we do what we think we're supposed to do, what our parents want us to do, institutions like colleges say we should do, the church, the culture, whatever that is. We say like, well, I can't be like this because something else is telling me I need to be like this. But it's, you know, when we start going down that path of being whatever someone else thinks we should be is when we find ourselves in the wrong room, because we're not using our voice, our intuition, our authentic self to be who we are. And for me, I was like, how old am I? I was 43 when I found that voice.
Wow.
And my 25-year-old would say like, you're so old. But my 46-year-old self says, I'm grateful I did when I did, because it's never too late to be who you are. And so what I wanted to do was help other women find that inner voice in whatever change or iteration or transition they're going through, to know that they're safe and loved and supported and heard. Because for so long, I felt silenced by the shame of my addiction. And it is not shameful. It's not a decision. It's a disease. And that disease has caused me or created who I am today. And I can say without hesitation that I love this person today. 2 years ago, I would have had probably a challenge saying that. But I fully embrace the messy, chaos, beauty, all of it, with authenticity. And I want to help other women feel that same love and to feel seen.
So much. And I love that you brought up COVID, because I think it exacerbated and amplified so much loneliness and isolation for so many people. And I think that you nailed it with, I think really the number one feeling I think humans have innately is to not feel alone. And if they start to feel alone, they start to feel isolated, they start to listen to voices that aren't true, and it starts to change the way they feel about themselves and their identity. And then it just keeps, it's a snowball effect, right? And then what you've done is you've created an environment where your story is not my story or her story or her story, but it doesn't matter. It's because everyone's story matters and everyone's story counts. And when you hear someone else's story, you can connect to it and feel that you're not alone, even though it wasn't your story. And you've created a room, in a lot of ways, a large community room for those who are trying to go through this to not feel alone. I think it's called The Right Room. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they can find more about The Right Room on your website. Tell the listeners where they can find that. And I know those listening, if you're a male listening, all these concepts still apply to you, but I bet you might have a female somewhere in your life that might need to hear this message, and get them over to Hillary's resources. Where can they go find more about that?
Thank you. Yeah, the idea of The Right Room is that my voice wasn't wrong. I was just in the wrong room. And so by finding people that support you and love the authentic, true version of you, that's the right room, whether that's actual physical surrounding yourself with people or virtually. And so in The Right Room, we do, or I do, like a high touch one-on-one coaching with women who are just looking for accountability, and just want to actions, accountability, resources to be who they want to be. And then we have group coaching for women as well. And it was funny because I came into this, I'm like, I want to help everybody. I want to help men, women, everyone. Like, my partner is really good. He's like, okay, but what? I'm like, I really want to help women because I know how lonely I felt and how unseen and unheard. So I want to give women that platform. You know, we have a couple of other things coming out. We have some 21-day challenges, some online things, some self-guided, just different in the purposes, so everybody can have access to the help and the healing that they are most comfortable with, whether that's, you know, one-on-one, whether it's group or whether it's self-guided. I talked a little bit about a project we have coming up, almost ready to share. That'll be out in the next month or so. And so that's really exciting. Doing a lot of speaking, but I just love meeting women where they are, because sometimes we just need someone to listen.
This is so good. And it's such an important time in our, and I think in our culture for this. You know, they always say that whole adage that, you know, hurt people, but healed people heal people.
That's right.
And I think you're providing a mechanism and a place for people to get that healing that they need so that they can turn around as our ultimate, I believe our ultimate purpose on this earth is to help serve others with the love that's inside of us inherently in the gifts that we have. But we don't get to do that when we're broken and we're feeling shame and guilt and we're living in that wrong room isolated. And then you've created a platform where women can start to get that healing they need. Well, no matter what the transition is in life, it doesn't have to be alcohol addiction. It could be anything that they're going through where they just need to know they're not alone and have someone speak life and love into them so that they can be inspired to go out and speak life and love into other people. And you're doing that. So thank you.
Thank you. And that's what I found. It's that ripple effect. You know, my partner says, and I adore him for this, the world would stop spinning in 24 hours if all women ceased to exist. He's like, women really carry the world. And I'm like, oh, I love you even more. And so I felt so great to have such an evolved person, male in my life. But he's, what I realized too is as women, we just carry things. We're like, yep, I'll do that at work. Yep, I'll do that at home. Of course I'll do that. Of course, there's no problem. We don't say no. And we're often the last ones to fill up our own cup. But to your point, what you were saying, yeah, without filling up our cup and really taking care of ourselves, it's hard to take care of others. But there is that ripple effect. One woman gets help, gets sober, gets healed, gets help, gets heard. That ripple effect is so powerful.
That's so good. Well, where can we go to find more? Tell us what the best place to go.
Yeah, the website's great, hillaryphelps.com. It's one L. I do share a lot on LinkedIn, Instagram. I really, really try to get, and I do, it just might take me a couple of days. I respond to every message I get personally. And so if you DM me or email me, I will get back to you and respond. If I don't have the answers, the beauty in that I've been doing this so long is that I do have resources of other people that can help, or I know where to go or where I can send you. And so I'm always willing to help or get on a Zoom if someone's like, can we just talk? I'm like, here's my calendar. Set up, we have 30 minutes. Let's set up a Zoom, because I do feel that my gift or my purpose in life is to help others.
Well, thank you for doing that and creating a platform to do so. So go to hillaryphelps.com, H-I-L-A-R-Y, one L.
That's right.
And learn more about Hillary. Bring her in to speak to your organization. If you're a leader out there or a female out there, rather, whether you're a leader or not, jump in there, learn more about her program and how you can join it as well. And it's been awesome having this conversation with you and learning your life story a little bit deeper and how you've turned your life story into your life's purpose. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll have you back on maybe toward the end of the season, get an update on how things are going.
I would love that. Thank you.
The Jim Stroud Podcast explores the discoveries and trends forming the future of our lives. Brain-to-brain communication, robot bosses, microchip implants for workers, and artificial intelligence replacing human workers are all happening now. If you want to know what's happening next, subscribe now to the Jim Stroud Podcast.